quote, "Yet some men say in many parts of England that King Arthur is not dead, but had by the will of our Lord Jesu into another place. And men say that he shall come again, and he shall win the Holy Cross."
Thomas Malory wrote those words in his 1485 account of the Arthurian legend Le Mort d'Arthur, which recounts the life and tragic death of King Arthur, the greatest king ever to rule Britain.
Arthur, Guinevere, Excalibur, tales of the fair, wise king and his knights of the round table have persisted for over 1,000 years.
But how much of the legend is fantasy, and how much of it is real? Did a king named Arthur really rule ancient England? Where do the facts end and the fantasies begin?
Hi, I'm Vanessa Richardson.
And I'm Carter Roy. Welcome to Historical Figures. Every other Wednesday, we discuss a different person's lasting historical impact, unique personality, and impression on the world around them.
Our audio biographies cover big lives, but we like to focus on little-known facts. Today, we're discussing the legendary King Arthur.
If you want to listen to any previous episodes, you can find them and all of Parcast shows on your favorite podcast directory.
A lot of you ask how to help the show. If you enjoy the podcast, the best way to help is to leave us a 5-star review.
Now, back to King Arthur.
Beginning sometime around the middle of the 6th century AD, legends of a great warrior king who defended Britain against invaders began to make their way around Wales.
Arthurian legend, or Arthuriana, is the genre of mythology surrounding King Arthur's personal life and rule, as well as the exploits of his knights of the Round Table, the search for the Holy Grail, and the downfall of Camelot.
Unlike most of the historical leaders we cover on this podcast, the basic facts about King Arthur's life are shrouded in mystery. Historians are unable to agree upon exactly when Arthur lived, what he did, and whether he was actually a real person at all.
Determining the source of the Arthurian legend and how much of the story is actually true has proven exceptionally difficult. The Cambridge Companion to the Arthurian legend says that, quote, "There is great uncertainty about the dating of Welsh Arthurian texts, some of which are believed to have had a long oral tradition before being committed to writing," end quote.
In the early tales, Arthur was a mountain of a man, impressive in both deed and stature. He was a ferocious warrior of inhuman skill who could win a battle single-handedly and defended Britain through sheer force of will. Because even the earliest Arthuriana portrays the king so fantastically, it can be difficult for modern historians to determine which parts of the legend are based on truth and which are not.
Discovering who the real King Arthur might have been is even more difficult. There are several historical candidates for a real Arthur, documented men upon whom the legends might be based.
But to understand the importance of King Arthur and the many real military leaders his legends may have been based on, we first have to understand the world Arthur is said to have lived in. Let's take a look at the British Isles during the 5th and 6th centuries AD, when the great King Arthur supposedly rose to power.
The area that we know as modern-day England was first invaded by the Roman Empire in 54 BC. Eventually, the Romans gained control over the entirety of modern-day England and Wales, assimilating them into the empire as the province of Britain.
The Romans found it much more difficult to take over Ireland and Scotland, which at the time were completely separate kingdoms from England and Wales. Nevertheless, the Roman Empire ruled over England and Wales until they eventually lost control of the British Isles in 410 AD.
At that point, there were 4 main cultural and ethnic groups competing for dominance in Britain. The natives, known as the Celts and Picts, the remaining Roman invaders, and the Saxons, or Germanic invaders. It was in the midst of this conflict that the King Arthur legend was born.
Several skirmishes broke out between the invading Saxons and the Celtic Britons throughout the 5th and 6th centuries AD. Perhaps the most important of these is the Battle of Mount Badon, fought around the turn of the 6th century.
Despite its name, historians are still unsure where exactly the battle occurred. Whichever peak might once have been called Mount Badon has been lost to time.
The Saxons and the Brits had been fighting for years with no end in sight. That all changed after the Britons won a major victory in the Battle of Badon. The resounding triumph managed to stave off Saxon invasions into the Isles for several decades, restoring relative peace to the region.
And who was leading the charge to dispel the Saxons at the Battle of Badon? According to some sources, it was King Arthur.
Not every source agrees on that point. The Battle of Badon was chronicled by St. Gildas the Wise, a 6th century monk who wrote an extensive history of Britain during the time of the Saxon invasions. Gildas's book, De Excidio et Conquestu Britanniae, is the only surviving historical source of the battle written by a near contemporary.
Gildas claimed to have been born in the same year as the Battle of Badon, and although he was writing just 40 years afterward, Gildas made no mention of King Arthur in his works. Instead, he attributes the British victory in the Battle of Badon to a Romano-British military leader named Ambrosius Aurelianus.
Other accounts of the time, such as the 12th century Life of Gildas, written by Caradoc of Llancarfan, suggest that Gildas knew of Arthur's existence, but intentionally did not include him because of a personal grudge.
In Llancarfan's version of events, St. Gildas was one of Arthur's subjects and revered the king. But when Gildas' elder brother Huel rebelled against Arthur's authority by plundering the king's village, Arthur pursued Huel back to his home and killed him. Gildas, torn between the king he loved and the brother he was bound to, retaliated by erasing Arthur from his entire history of Britain.
It's worth remembering that Llancarfan was writing 600 years after Gildas lived. In all probability, his story was based on oral histories that may have warped into complete fiction over the years.
There is another possibility for why Arthur doesn't appear in Gildas's book. Modern historians have postulated that perhaps Arthur's involvement in the Battle of Badon was so widely known that Gildas simply didn't bother spelling it out in his book, assuming the audience would already know about the king.
Still, the fact that Arthur doesn't appear in any written history until the mid-9th century, almost 300 years after his supposed rule, leads some historians to believe that the man was not real, or at the very least, he didn't participate in the Battle of Badon.
The first written mention of Arthur is recorded in the Historia Brittonum, circa 828 AD, almost 300 years after Gildas wrote his history. The Historia, commonly attributed to a Welsh monk named Nennius, is based on a number of Celtic oral mythologies, including tales of a military leader named Arthur.
Notably, while the Historia discusses Arthur at length, it doesn't mention him being a king. He's referred to only as a Dux Bellorum, or war leader.
Nennius details 12 great battles in which Arthur fought and conquered, gradually driving the Saxons out of Wales and England. One of these 12 is the Battle of Badon.
The monk's version of the battle paints Arthur as a formidable, superhuman warrior king, almost single-handedly responsible for driving the Saxons back to Germany. He wrote, quote, "The 12th battle was on Mount Badon, in which there fell in one day 960 men from one charge by Arthur, and no one struck them down except Arthur himself. And in all the wars he emerged as a victor," end quote.
Single-handedly striking down 960 soldiers in one charge is certainly a feat.
Once again, the exaggeration makes it impossible to tell how much of the story is fact and how much is pure fabrication. The Historia Brittonum also includes details about Arthur's son, Amra, and his dog, Cobble, both of whom were altered or totally omitted in later Arthurian legends.
After the Historia in 828, there were no major developments in the King Arthur legend for another 300 years until 1136, when Geoffrey of Monmouth wrote a fictionalized chronicle of British royalty, called Historia Regum Britannia, That's Latin for History of the Kings of Britain.
Geoffrey's book was one of the most popular books of the Middle Ages, and it's still one of the greatest sources of King Arthur legends today. In fact, the book shaped the legend in so many ways that historians divide Arthuriana into two groups, pre-Galfridian texts and post-Galfridian texts.
The history of the kings of Britain spanned the centuries between Brutus, the Trojan settlement of Britain, and extermination of the native giants around 138 BC, and the mid-6th century reign of Arthur and his mentor, the magician Merlin.
Needless to say, Geoffrey's history isn't bound by modern standards of factuality. He intertwined actual historical events with fantastical elements, like giants and wizards. But historically accurate or not, Geoffrey's version of the King Arthur story was the basis for most of the additional legends that came afterward.
The first six volumes of the history concern the settlement of Britain and the Romans' conquest and loss of the Isle. Book 7 contains several of Merlin's prophecies, and books 8 through 12 concern Arthur's birth, life, and death.
Geoffrey claimed to have adapted his history from an ancient British book provided by the Archdeacon of Oxford, but historians agree this is fiction. Instead, Geoffrey appears to have assembled the book from embellished bits of several older works, including Gildas' text about the Saxon invasions.
Geoffrey of Monmouth gives us the first recorded account of King Arthur's birth. He wrote that the coming of the once and future king, as Arthur came to be known, was ordained by the wizard Merlin.
Before Arthur was born, his father, Uther Pendragon, was a mighty king, and Britain flourished under his rule. The only problem was that Uther was madly in love with Igraine, the wife of his friend, Gorlois.
When Gorlois found out about this, he left Uther's court abruptly. This offended Uther, and it set off a battle between the two former friends. Uther turned to the wizard Merlin for help.
Merlin's idea of helping was to disguise Uther as Gorlois. While in disguise, Uther snuck into his enemy's castle and tricked Gorlois' wife, Igraine, into sleeping with him.
Igraine gave birth to a baby boy, Arthur, 9 months later, the illegitimate child of enemy kingdoms. Uther had promised his firstborn to Merlin in exchange for the wizard's help, and so Arthur was handed over to be raised by the sorcerer, far from court. Merlin raised Arthur to become the next king, and Arthur assumed the throne at 15, after his ailing father died defending Britain from the Saxon invaders.
The young Welsh king proved to be a formidable warrior, and he soon won a series of battles against the Germanic Saxons, as well as the native Scots and Picts. After these conquests, he created a united Britain for the first time in history.
12 years of peace passed while Arthur and his queen Guinevere ruled over the united Britain. He charged into every battle with his famous sword Excalibur, forged on the mystical island of Avalon.
Then, when he was in his 30s, Arthur decided not to just maintain and defend his British Empire, but to expand it. His forces rode into Ireland, Scandinavia, and Gaul, or modern-day France.
At the time, Gaul was still part of the Roman Empire. Arthur's invasion of the territory led to another clash between the Roman Empire and Britain. Only this time, it was Britain invading the Romans, not the other way around.
Arthur won the clash with the help of his legendary cadre of chivalric knights. Arthur rode into Gaul with Sirs Kay, Bedivere, and Gawain, three of the knights who would remain members of his inner circle throughout future legends.
Sir Lancelot, who would become the most famous of Arthur's knights, is never mentioned by Geoffrey of Monmouth.
Arthur's knights, wrote Geoffrey, were, quote, famous for feats of chivalry, wore their clothes and arms all of the same color and fashion, and had given a proof of their valor in three several battles, end quote.
The phrase three several comes to us courtesy of Old English. Their famous chivalry was inspired by Arthur himself, who Geoffrey said, quote, introduced such politeness into his court as people of the remotest countries thought worthy of their imitation, end quote.
Once Gaul was won, Arthur set his sights on conquering Rome itself. But his progress was cut short by his own nephew, Mordred, who had taken advantage of his uncle's absence from Britain to seize the throne and marry Arthur's wife, Guinevere.
Instead of invading Rome, Arthur was forced to return to Britain and defend his throne. He killed his nephew Mordred in battle, but Arthur himself was mortally wounded in the process. He was sent to the mystical Isle of Avalon to be healed, but it was too late to save him.
Geoffrey wrote, quote, "And even the renowned King Arthur himself was mortally wounded, and being carried thence to the Isle of Avalon to be cured of his wounds, he gave up the crown of Britain to his kinsman Constantine, the son of Cador, Duke of Cornwall, in the 542nd year," end quote.
And there Arthur's legend ends, with the king carried away to a magical land of reincarnation in the year 542. Geoffrey leaves open the possibility that Arthur might one day return when Britain really needed him.
Unfortunately, though, the British Isles have been through countless wars in the intervening centuries. The once and future king has thus far failed to reappear.
But that doesn't mean no one has looked for him. King Arthur was supposedly killed and carried away to Avalon in the mid-6th century, but the search for his body continued for centuries.
Coming next, we'll explore those searches.
Now, back to the story. King Arthur was one of the most famous figures of the medieval age, but still, the truth about his origins are in question. Without reliable evidence of his existence, historical British leaders were unable to prove King Arthur's actuality, but that didn't stop them from trying.
British monarchs, particularly Henry II and his successor, Richard I, looked for evidence of Arthur's existence in order to bolster their own claims to the throne. If they could find evidence of some connection with the ever-popular Arthur, such a kinship could only boost their own popularity with the people.
To that end, in 1190, Henry II authorized an excavation of the grounds of Glastonbury Abbey, one of a few possible candidates for the real-life location of the island Avalon. Glastonbury was a historically important religious site, and it had once been an island due to the natural movements of the surrounding rivers.
During the excavation, two skeletons were found buried in the abbey. A cross-shaped plaque identified the corpses as Guinevere and Arthur.
Glastonbury had been settled by the Britons in the mid-5th century, around the time of Arthur's death, which lent some credence to the findings. However, modern historians have noted that the cross plaque the excavators found is inconsistent with genuine 5th century artifacts. As for the skeletons, they both disappeared sometime in the 1700s, making it impossible for today's archaeologists to examine them.
Most historians and archaeologists today infer that the bodies and the plaque were planted by Henry II before his death and then discovered by Richard I a few years later as a carefully orchestrated popularity campaign.
Though the Arthurian legend was already a part of British culture in the centuries before Geoffrey of Monmouth's Historia Regum Britannia, it didn't really blossom into the extensive mythological tradition we know today until Geoffrey's work inspired other European authors to embellish the legend in later centuries.
Playing to the literary trends of the day, these authors took the battle-hardened Arthur of Geoffrey's work and transformed him into a wise and calm king who ruled in peacetime and whose fatal flaw lay in his reluctance to act.
This is also when famous Arthurian symbols like the sword and the stone, the Lady of the Lake, and characters like Lancelot were first introduced.
Sirs Percival, Upda, and Gawain, who were briefly mentioned in Geoffrey's book, earned their own tales, as did the legendary lovers Tristan and Isolde. In these later myths, the king himself took a back seat, ruling Camelot in the background, while his knights went on grand quests to meet the Fisher King and search for the Holy Grail.
One of the most important of these later Arthurian works is the 13th century French Vulgate cycle. Its 5 books detail 2 of the most famous stories in the Arthurian tradition. Lancelot and Guinevere's betrayal, and Arthur's knights' search for the Holy Grail.
Sir Lancelot was one of Arthur's best friends and most trusted knights until he betrayed Arthur by beginning a love affair with his wife Guinevere. After its first appearance in the French Vulgate cycle, the story was included in most later Arthurian texts.
The Holy Grail, on the other hand, first appeared in Arthuriana as early as the 1190s. The Grail was a cup or chalice that was said to provide the owner with eternal youth or happiness. Although it was originally a pagan symbol, later French Christian writers intertwined it with imagery and symbolism of the chalice used by Christ at the Last Supper, infusing their Christian values into the ancient Welsh tale.
Even as contemporary values and literary and religious trends changed, the symbolism of the Arthurian legend adapted. What had begun as just another quest to illustrate the bravery of Arthur's knights morphed into a grand symbolic journey meant to evaluate the worthiness of King Arthur to possess a relic of God.
The Vulgate cycle was followed by the most famous Arthurian work of all, Sir Thomas Malory's late 15th century La Morte d'Arthur. This is the most recognizable version of the legend to modern readers. It detailed the king's life from birth through his death, though the focus of the story is, as the name suggests, on Arthur's death.
Sir Thomas Malory was a famous degenerate who was imprisoned multiple times for theft, murder, rape, and a plot to overthrow King Edward IV.
Well, sounds like a nice guy.
He really, really wasn't. But one thing he had a genuine passion for, other than crime, was Arthurian legend. Malory used his last and longest stint in London's Newgate Prison to write the entirety of La Morte d'Arthur.
This version of the story expands upon Arthur's birth and ascension to the throne. In La Morte d'Arthur, when Arthur's father, King Uther Pendragon, dies, he proclaims Arthur his heir. But Arthur, who had been taken away by Merlin as an infant, is nowhere to be found.
Powerful lords begin to fight over the empty throne, and the kingdom splinters. But then Merlin tells the Archbishop of Canterbury to summon all the warring lords to a churchyard on Christmas Eve, where he promises the issue of Uther's throne will be resolved.
The lords all gather at the churchyard. At exactly midnight, a sword appears in the middle of the yard, stuck into a stone bearing the inscription, quote, "Whoso pulleth out this sword of this stone and anvil is rightways king born of all England," end quote.
The lords all tried to free the sword from the stone, but none of them were able to do it. Only Arthur, a young nobody from the edges of the kingdom, was able to pull the sword out of the stone.
The lords initially refused to accept Arthur as their new king, but the common people rally behind Arthur, and by popular demand, he assumes the throne.
In this version of the story, Arthur's demise is a self-fulfilling prophecy, which begins when he unwittingly conceives a son named Mordred with his own half-sister, the witch Morgause.
Morgause, Arthur knew, was the daughter of Igraine and Gorlois, Uther Pendragon's former rival. What Arthur didn't know was that Uther was his father, and Igraine was his own mother.
Merlin appears to Arthur in the guise of a prophetic child and tells the king the truth of his royal parentage. Not only is Arthur truly the natural heir to the kingdom, but he's just slept with his own sister. Merlin prophesies that the child conceived from their union will one day destroy the kingdom.
On Merlin's advice, Arthur attempts to get rid of the child by sending all of Camelot's babies on a ship out to sea. The ship sinks, killing all the babies on board, except Mordred, who survives and is fostered by a good man until he reaches his early teens.
The teenage Mordred reappears and becomes a knight in Arthur's court. Mordred knows he's Arthur's illegitimate son, and he harbors a grudge against his father for the circumstances of his birth.
At first, Mordred appears content just to act as one of Arthur's famously courteous knights, but then he discovers Guinevere and Lancelot's secret affair.
In La Morte d'Arthur, the affair between Arthur's best friend and his wife begins innocently enough. Lancelot admires Guinevere from afar, excelling at quests and tournaments in order to impress her. But after he's tricked into fathering a child with another woman who's disguised as Guinevere, Lancelot realizes he's got a serious problem.
Lancelot leaves the court and goes mad for some time, torn between his love for Guinevere and his duty to the king. When he eventually returns, he fights for the favor of other women as a way to throw the king off his scent.
Unfortunately, Guinevere gets jealous of the attention Lancelot is giving to other women and exiles him from court.
Later, Guinevere is accused of poisoning a knight, and Lancelot returns to defend her. This is when their affair begins in earnest. Mordred and another knight, Sir Agravain, learn of their indiscretion and use the information to incite a war between Arthur and Lancelot.
Arthur leaves Camelot to fight Lancelot. While he's gone, Mordred usurps the throne and circulates false claims that his father Arthur has died in battle. He also proposes to Guinevere, his stepmother.
That's gross.
You're not wrong. In order to take back the throne, Arthur is forced to return and fight Mordred for control of the kingdom.
During the war, Arthur has a dream that he'll die the next day if he fights Mordred. His knights advise him to end the battle and broker a peace with Mordred instead.
Mordred and Arthur agree to sign a treaty. But while they're having their peace talks, a snake appears on the battlefield and disturbs Mordred's knights, who resume the fighting. In the resulting battle, Mordred and Arthur fight each other, and both are fatally wounded.
In La Morte d'Arthur, unlike in Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain, Arthur is borne across the water on a barge to die. He's buried in a tomb below the inscription, "Here lies Arthur, king who was and king who will be."
After La Morte d'Arthur, countless more adaptations of the Arthur legend have appeared, in versions as varied as Disney's animated The Sword in the Stone and Monty Python's musical Spamalot. In fact, so many different retellings of the story exist that it can be nearly impossible to keep them straight.
Like Caesar or Charlemagne, King Arthur's rule spawned centuries of legends. But unlike those two rulers, historians still aren't sure whether or not Arthur truly existed.
Even today, the question remains, if King Arthur is based on a real historical figure, who was he?
Up next, we'll try to figure it out. Now back to the story.
The legend of King Arthur is one of the most well-known and best-loved myths of all time. But the origins of the lore remain a mystery. Even just a few decades after his death, those recording Britain's history seemed uncertain about the great king's beginnings.
There are several documented men upon whom King Arthur may have been based. The first serious candidate is Lucius Arturus Castus, a Roman military centurion who lived in the province of Britain sometime between the late 2nd and mid-3rd centuries.
All we know about Lucius Arturus Castus today comes from two fragmented sources, the remains of a sarcophagus and an ancient plaque, both found in Croatia. These inscriptions confirm that Lucius was a powerful centurion who led British forces against the Armenians.
Kemp Malone, a medievalist at Johns Hopkins University, was the first to suggest Lucius Arturus Castus as an Arthur candidate in 1924. His logic was based largely upon the name Arthur, which sounds similar to Arturus, and upon the king's early depictions as a fearsome warrior.
It's easy to see how Arturus might morph into Arthur over centuries of oral legend. Several other historians have supported Malone's theory. The main problem with this theory, of course, is that Lucius Arturus lived almost 300 years before the first Arthurian stories are set.
That doesn't necessarily rule him out as their inspiration. It is possible that tales of the great Roman warrior were passed down over generations and incorporated into stories of the time. Thus, the 3rd century protector of Roman Britannia becomes the 5th century defender of Britain against the Saxons.
Still, because of the huge gap in time between Arturus' life and the first written appearance of King Arthur, most historians are hesitant to support Malone's theory.
Another possible Arthur candidate is Owain Donnean, a Welsh prince who ruled Ross around 440 AD. Graham Phillips, a British author and former BBC radio reporter, is the biggest proponent of this theory.
This theory, too, is based mostly on names. In the ancient British language Brythonic, the name Arthur closely resembles the word for bear. Owain was nicknamed the Bear in his lifetime, so Phillips reasons this moniker might have morphed into Arthur over time.
Another piece of evidence is the location of Owain Donnean's kingdom, which was considered the mightiest stronghold in mid-5th century Britain. If Arthur really defended all of Britain from one stronghold, it's likely he did it from there.
Owain Donnean was a fierce warrior, like Arthur, and lived much closer in time to the first Arthurian stories than Lucius Arturus Castus did. But despite Phillips' extensive book supporting his theory, Owain Donnean has failed to gain traction as a serious Arthur candidate.
Another possible Arthur is the 5th century warrior, Ambrosius Aurelianus, who we mentioned earlier. St. Gildas attributed the victory at the Battle of Badon to Ambrosius in his book, De Excidio et Conquestu Britannia.
Ambrosius Aurelianus would be a strong Arthurian candidate due to his known war victories and the fact that he lived around the same time as the legendary Arthur. The only hitch is that he actually appears as a separate character in several Arthurian texts.
As early as Nennius's Historia Britonum, Ambrosius's accomplishments were recorded in British myth. In later Arthuriana, Ambrosius appeared as Uther Pendragon's brother and Arthur's uncle, part of the story but not its focus.
That only leaves one serious contender for the original Arthur figure, Riotimus, a 5th century Roman-British military leader known as the King of the Britons.
Well, the first recorded account of Riotimus appears in the Getica, a history of the Gothic people written in the 6th century. That's around the same time the first mention of Arthur appears.
According to the Getica, Riotimus ruled Britain during the Saxon invasion. He was sought after by the Roman emperor in order to join forces and drive off the Saxons for good.
Riotimus fought in Gaul during this campaign, as did Arthur in some versions of the legend. But Riotimus's invasion of Gaul didn't end up sparking a war with the Romans, like Arthur's did. In fact, according to the Getica, he was actually working with the Romans to defend Gaul.
Sometime around the year 470, Gaul was invaded by an army of Visigoths, and the Roman emperor turned to the Britons for help. According to the Getica, quote, "Their king Riotimus came with 12,000 men into the state of the Biturigus by the way of Ocean and was received as he disembarked from his ships," end quote.
This places Riotimus in Gaul at the exact same time as Arthur's Gaelic campaigns took place in Geoffrey of Monmouth's account.
The discrepancy between Riotimus's alliance with Rome and Arthur's war against Rome might be attributed to cultural changes over time. The Getica was written several hundred years before Geoffrey of Monmouth's Historia, when Britain still retained a lot of Roman influence from their years as part of the empire. By the time Geoffrey wrote his version of the Arthur legend, the Roman influence on culture had faded, so the story may have been changed to reflect the popular values of the time.
Another interesting detail to note is what we know about Riotimus's temperament and manner of rule. A letter written to Riotimus by Sidonius Apollinaris, a Roman politician and bishop, recounts the case of a man whose slaves are being stolen by the Bretons from a region of modern-day France. He asks Riotimus to look into the man's claim and deal out justice.
Sidonius Apollinaris says, quote, "I do my best to remember the burdensome and delicate sense of honor which makes you so ready to blush for others' faults," end quote.
Justice, honor, kindness? Sounds a lot like King Arthur.
The coincidences don't end there. In the Getica, Riotimus was betrayed by one of his close advisors, who cooperated with the invading Saxons while he was off fighting in Gaul. This echoes Arthur's betrayal by Mordred.
And perhaps most interestingly, Riotimus also disappeared after being fatally wounded on his way to a town called Avalon, the same place Arthur is supposed to have gone to be resurrected.
Since Geoffrey of Monmouth was known to have built his King Arthur myth from a variety of sources, it's more than possible that he used parts of the Getica to inspire his version of Arthur.
There are a few issues with this theory, of course. For one, Riotimus is a very different name from Arthur, and it seems unlikely that his name could have shifted so drastically over years of oral tradition.
Geoffrey Ashe, the most prominent proponent of the Riotimus as Arthur theory, explains away this hitch by claiming that Riotimus is not actually a name at all, but a title. According to Ashe, Riotimus is a compound of two bastardized Latin words meaning king and high ruler. Therefore, there's no reason why a man named Arthur couldn't have been known to history as Riotimus.
There's another damning piece of evidence against this theory. Some historians doubt whether Riotimus was even really British.
Both Sidonius Apollinaris and Jordanus refer to him as King of the Britons, spelled B-R-I-T-T-O-N-E-S. It's unclear whether they're referring to the Britons, B-R-I-T-O-N-S, from the British Isles, or to the Bretons, B-R-E-T-O-N-S, a people from the Brittany region of modern-day France.
Because Sidonius Apollinaris specifically asked Riotimus to intervene in a case involving Bretons, some historians reason that Riotimus was probably the king of Brittany, not Britain. If that's the case, Riotimus would be a poor candidate for Arthur, the most famous British king of all time.
Despite all the similarities between Riotimus and King Arthur, there's just enough contradictory evidence to throw a wrench in the case. But until a better candidate presents himself, Riotimus appears to be the most likely inspiration for King Arthur.
King Arthur's tale is steeped in murky origins and contradictory characterizations. Warrior or peacetime king, defender of Britain or champion of chivalry. But what's indisputable is that, real or not, Arthur is one of the most influential figures in British history.
Legends of King Arthur and his Knights of the Round Table are an integral part of British identity. They've been used by kings wishing to drum up support for the monarchy and by supporters of democracy to back up their political ideals.
Arthur's Round Table of Knights stands as an early example of a congress or parliament, a group of trusted advisors to the ruler. In fact, the modern phrase, round table, referring to a conference or discussion in which everyone participates equally, comes from the King Arthur legend.
King Arthur's influence certainly hasn't diminished over the centuries. He appears as a star of modern works like T.S. White's The Once and Future King, Transformers The Last Knight, and the Hellboy comics. The king we know today may bear little to no resemblance to the man he's based on, if he was based on a real man at all, but that doesn't make his stories any less impactful.
King Arthur stands as a paragon of what man can be. He is the once and future king, always alive in the modern imagination, even when so many other stories have faded. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Historical Figures.
A new episode releases every other Wednesday. You can listen to all of Parcast's shows on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, CastBox, Spotify, or your favorite podcast directory.
If you enjoy the podcast, the best way to help is to leave us a 5-star review wherever you listen.
Thanks for listening.
We'll see you next time.
Historical Figures was created by Max Cutler. It is a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Russell Nash, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Historical Figures is written by Colleen Bradley and stars Vanessa Richardson and Carter Roy.